Welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. Today, we've got a very special guest. Me and Jack are sat here in our last podcast before Christmas, and we thought, how could we get a Christmas present for ourselves? So we've invited on a man who shares a similar ethos to us, but he's taken it a step further. It's sales extraordinaire and author of Unselling 14 Unconventional Principles to Reduce Sales Anxiety and Increase Sales. It's only bloody Kevin Casey. Kevin, how are you?
Oh, I'm Jack and Zach's lump of coal this Christmas. This is the last podcast. So here I am, the lump of coal.
This is the one we're looking forward to the most.
Well, don't
So,
tell
Kevin,
Benjamin that. Oh, guys, now you're going to cause a war.
that's
Keep
what we're at.
going.
We're making controversy. That's what we want. We want war.
Course.
So, we always start these podcasts off the same way. So, who are you and what problem do you solve?
Wow, I'm not Benjamin Dennehy. I am Kevin Casey. Much better looking than Benjamin. I got the square jawline, unlike Benjamin, with no suspenders, but blatant logo, which is kind of like opposite of on selling. So I'm somewhat disappointed in my attire. But I work with entrepreneurs, and there's a lot of them out there that are carrying a secret, and the secret is that they're either scared shitless of selling, and they haven't told anyone. Or they're riddled with anxiety and they haven't told anyone because they're running the business. And I kind of help them not be the best seller in the world. I help them get over that anxiety and actually start doing the thing they've been avoiding their whole life.
So you said then scared of selling. So I think that feels like something that no one would probably admit, and maybe they'd be unconscious of even feeling it in the first place. What are typically the symptoms of someone who's scared of selling? What is their day like? What are they noticing?
I'll give you a recent example. 2 days ago, I had to take a flight up to Toronto, and someone that bought my book was in the seat next to me. And when they saw me coming, they hid the book because they didn't want to admit that they needed the book. And that's okay. The symptoms are this. I can tell you, I've had a business for Since 2002, I've owned my own business. And you guys know this is scary stuff. And it's probably the loneliest job in the world if you're by yourself. I didn't have a Jack or a Zach. At times, it was just me. And no one really taught us how to do this stuff. Yet, everyone in your company who counts on you to make payroll believes that you're the person that must understand how to grow the business and do business development. But really, at 3 a.m. in the morning, you know, the secret is that one, I don't know where to start. So I'm going to do a website and I'm going to create lead generation and I'm going to work on a better business card and a better logo. Or two, I'm actually doing it totally wrong, but my staff don't know it, but nothing's working. So I'm keeping the secret because no one knows better than me. And the third thing they do is something I call sales incest, which is in the book, which you hang around with other miserable business owners who also suck at selling, and you all pass around like some kind of bad gift exchange. Here's the stuff that didn't work for me. You try it, and you come back next week and tell me how bad it was. This is what's going on with business owners, and I've been one, and I've been in that situation where misery loves company. And it's no one really admits this, but the person you admit it to is the person you see in the mirror every morning saying, I don't know where to start, but I can't admit it because of ego, which we all have.
We all definitely do have Kevin. So Unselling, 5 stars, number one. Could you break down to the audience and for people that haven't read it, maybe Unselling in a nutshell, maybe give us like an elevator pitch?
Well, it's really a tale of two worlds. So I've sold my whole life. Mom wanted one of us to go to medical school out of four kids, and we all failed her. And I was the youngest, so I was the last great hope. And of course, I turned out to be in sales. The word on selling was actually in my mind in 2012 when that incident that the book starts off with, called A Rude Awakening, happened. And I just wasn't feeling good. I mean, we had a marketing agency. We're at 15 people, but I just didn't like the person in the mirror, and I wasn't very proud of the way I sold. And I think I had really bad role models, like we all get from Hollywood. And I liked Ari Gold on Entourage, which was a show. I'm not sure if you guys had that, but he was like a flamboyant salesperson. I probably followed Grant Cardone, but I just didn't like the way I felt. And if my mother or father, and I lost my dad in 2019, but I think if my father was a fly in the wall or my mother and they saw how I sold, they'd be pretty disappointed in some of the situations that I tried trickery and pushiness. On selling to me was about opposites. And between 2012 and 2020, I tried about 25 opposites, which I call Costanzas in the book after George Costanza, because I like my mentors short with receding hairlines. They're my favorite mentors because they remind me of me. And I tried 25 Costanzas. And when COVID hit and I had this idea of writing the book, I wrote about the 14 that stuck. And it was the 14 that stuck for my sales team and for other entrepreneurs that I knew were struggling with this. And I left out all the crap that didn't work. And there was a lot of colossal failures, as you know, if you try sales. But on-selling is the opposite of selling, because the way we're taught is just so wrong. But we all follow each other, and it's we turn to these carbon copy salespeople, and you feel safe because you're surrounded by people doing the same thing. So the on-selling, opposite of selling.
You spoke there, Kevin, about the moment where you looked in the mirror and you didn't feel proud of who that was. Do you have anything anecdotally from when you were selling calls, discovery calls, sales meetings, anything where you look back now and now you do the opposite and you think that was a real red flag, like anything anecdotally where you're like, it might irk you, but this is a safe space. We've got you back, Kevin. Don't worry if you want to go down memory lane. Guys,
we've all, I mean, you know, April 18th, 2012 was my breakout day. And that was the day that, you know, we were an agency of 15 people. We were through a grueling 3-month process. I mean, the only people get treated worse than salespeople are people of creative ad agencies, because we got to do so much spec work back then for free. No one would ask an engineer to build a bridge or a building for free, or an architect to build a house for free and draft it. But I seem to follow careers where you can get used and abused pretty heavy. We were at the very final stages of this. I didn't even have my creative team on the phone because it was down to 3 agencies in Canada. And they were throwing confetti all over me. And you got to remember, one of the things about salespeople is we only hear the happy things. I mean, I had ears the size of Dumbo because all I could hear were the good things. And I muted out all the things that were so obvious when you look back at it. And this call was going great. We were kind of turning the final screws and we were saying goodbye to each other. And I was kind of popping the champagne in my head, like, we've got this. This is going to double the size of our agency. The other thing salespeople do, we just look for people to be happy and tell us the right things. And we believe the meeting went well. And I just hit the wrong button. I hit the mute button on one of these, before Zoom and all these fancy things we got. This was a conference call unit, the really awkward oblong unit. And I hit the red button, which was the mute button. And they didn't realize I hung up and they kept talking. And the same people that were throwing confetti over me 30 seconds ago were now talking about they're not good enough to switch for. I don't like the fact they're that far away from us. We got an agency down the road that we can deal with. And Larry, why don't you go back and push Kevin on production costs so we can try to save some bucks with the incumbent? And I listened to all this for what felt like an eternity. It might have been 10 or 12 seconds. And then I hit the right red button, which is to hang up. And for about 10 seconds, I was pissed off at them and the world. And about 10 more seconds passed, and I realized this was my fault. Because I never allowed people an environment to be truthful. I never once said the words, if this is not feeling right or we're not connecting, are you okay telling me no? I wouldn't dare say that. I didn't have the courage to say that. So I realized at this point that I can't do this for another 20 years. Like, yeah, I built a business selling average, but man, I got to look at myself in the mirror and realize the reason why they lied to me is because they couldn't be truthful. And they're the four people that I sent my book to first, by the way. The first four copies of the book went to them. I don't know if they figured it out because I've gotten zero for four. They worked with three different companies. I didn't send out a vengeance. I just said, I wanted to thank you because it wasn't all your deal. I caused most of this because you couldn't be truthful to me. And I don't know if it's not reached them or not, but I had to get that out of my system. But I didn't do it because I was angry. And it was that moment that I started changing things. And that's where the on-selling came in. It was exact moment that I said, I can't do this anymore. But it was my fault. And part of before that, the Kevin Casey wouldn't have taken accountability. We would have said, they're shitty prospects. I can't believe they do that to me. We never had a chance to win it. It was my fault.
So it sounds like that was someone else holding the dirty mirror up to you and saying, have a look at this. This is the reality.
It was a fork in the road. I was either going to power through it and blame it on someone else or find a way to do something completely separate. It was a different world in 2013. There's so many great people, you know, you guys included, that you can learn from. Back then, it really wasn't. Most of the sales books I had then were like 10 exit, go for yes harder, go for yes with a sledgehammer, it just kept going on. So I had to experiment with myself and I had to go against my instincts every single time. And I called them Costanzas because of that episode of Seinfeld. And I'm not sure if you guys ever saw this one where, you know, Jerry told George Costanza, you know, George is always moaning on about his life, probably the same way I was as a salesperson and many salespeople. They blame it on everyone else. And George goes to this diner and he's talking to Jerry Seinfeld, who's the star of the show. And Jerry said, George, if everything you've done is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right. So George sitting there says, okay. And he orders the opposite lunch than he did the other 100 times. And then Elaine looks over and sees a girl at the bar. And Elaine says, George, that girl over at the bar was just looking over our way. And George says, Elaine, women do not look at men who live with their mother, short, bald, and unemployed. And Jerry just said, George, if the opposite would be right, just do the opposite. Like, go over. And he went over, pulled up his khakis, kind of walked across, frog in the throat. And he tapped her on the shoulder and said, I noticed you were looking over at my table. She goes, yeah, you ordered the same lunch I did. And then he gets this moment of courage on opposite and says, hi, my name is George. I live with my mother and I'm unemployed. And the whole diner braces for impact. Millions on TV brace for impact. And she says, hi, my name is Victoria. And they start dating. So that was the moment to me that I said, I don't want commandments or laws. I just want Costanzas. And that's what I started to do, was the opposites. And the book is about the 14 that worked. And I left out all the crap that didn't. And it's when I actually felt proud to sell versus embarrassed of the way I was selling before.
So I suppose for you personally, what's the most extreme example then of something that you thought the total opposite to what's in the book? The one that was like, I always thought that, and then this is the one now where I've completely changed perspective. Like, which one stands as the strongest one for you personally?
Well, I don't know if it's because of my Catholic upbringing in an all-boys school, but, you know, we were taught to be formal and professional and enthusiastic and passionate. Well, first of all, any level of hypiness, and I naturally would have that built into my DNA, I have really got to tone that down. So one of the Castans is, you know, is don't show up hyping and enthusiastic and show up chilled out. And that changed my life, because think of the used car salesperson or someone who's passionate about what they sell. Your first reflex is to put up the shield, like, oh, I just don't want to deal with this. That's where think it overs or call me next quarter comes from. So one of the ones I loved, the biggest one probably is enthusiasm. And now I've learned to show up a little indifferent. That doesn't mean rude. It just means that I show up a little on okay. And my gosh, even my mother, who's 87, if she saw the way I write emails now and I talk to CEOs, she'd be mortified, because that's not the way I was brought up. But the point is, I'm okay with being a little on okay. And I'm okay with using 5-cent words instead of $50 words, because no one really likes the smartest kid in the class.
What's that? What does that mean? 5-cent, that there might be a crossover?
Well, you guys know what I mean. We've seen really, you guys are training someone new last week. You know their natural inclination is, as soon as they leave you guys and they talk to someone, they want to sound smarter. Because deep down inside, maybe you wanted to go to medical school also. I don't know. But we suddenly use words like, you know, we have an innovative product that can streamline your operations. We're ISO certified. And it's like, people don't even know what it means. So now, you know, I sell insurance, business insurance. Now, guys, if you're at a party and you admit you sell business insurance, you're drinking alone in the corner. Like, it's just happening. So if someone says to me, what do you do? I think 5-cent words. I said, yeah, I help business owners avoid the 3 a.m. sweats. And then I just shut up. And they kind of, what do you mean? How do they avoid the 3 a.m. sweats? Well, you know how that bad thing, you think it'll never happen to you, and then it does? I'm the guy that says you probably don't care if Geico saves you 15% or not at that moment. And they're like, shit, okay, that sounds, it's a lot better than saying I'm an insurance broker. You know, you guys called your, you called your brand the benefit. The biggest fear that your clients have going to you guys is like, we can't get meetings. What do you think we should call the company? I have a meeting. Like, it goes, committees would not have approved, by the way, that name. They would have said Global Lead Generation by CEO Zach and Jack. Like, they wouldn't have done it. So one of the biggest opposites to me is now I'm just me. For the first time in my life, and you guys have found it earlier than me, I'm 55. It's only the last 10 years. I sell the way I am, and I don't try to pretend to be somebody else.
So I imagine you've sort of just answered this one. But obviously, there's a lot of sales methodologies, and I'm sure you've noticed when we post on LinkedIn, I've got this same guy, I won't name him, comments on all the posts, he just puts, no, wouldn't work. Bear in mind, with both, you know, we've all got businesses built around this, there's money being made and evidence that it does work. So when people now reach out to you, because you've got your name attached to a book, it says, this is what I believe. When people now maybe comment or reach out to you saying that doesn't work or they disagree, what's your relationship like now with, you know, that saying, I don't believe you, Kevin, you're lying. What's your relationship with that like?
Well, here's the good news. Go to kevincasey.ca. You realize I'm not selling anything. I don't do coaching. I don't do one-on-one coaching. I don't do group coaching. I don't have a Kajabi account with 85 videos to burn someone's eyes out on a steps of unselling. I got a book, and a book that I decide to write that sells for about the cost of 2 Big Mac combos. I've got 21 sales reps underneath me now. Not every single one of them follow the on-selling principle. And I'm okay with it, because I am past the point of forcing someone to do this. And if someone feels comfortable with Sandler or with Keenum and Gap or with Benjamin, that's cool. Just follow something. The one things I say to people is that I don't think it'll work for me. then do something. But if you cannot get up in front of a whiteboard with me and in 15 seconds draw out in a marker what your sales process is, then I know ego's in the way and you don't have a clue what you're doing. And the scariest thing I could say to you, scarier than the girl on the ring, scarier than Freddy Krueger, would be, let's just role play it out and see how it goes. And all of a sudden, the 6 foot, 215 pound man just turned into the weakling on a beach. Role playing, I think, is the scariest thing in the world for people who are living a lie and they really don't have a sales process. So I don't convince anyone of anything. If it doesn't stick, go to someone else you feel more comfortable with. I don't think the on-selling works for everybody. I would just say pick a goddamn process, please, because winging it is what I did in 2012 and before. And that's not a life, that's a life sentence.
I love that response. And that is very unselling as a response, Kevin, rather than sitting there saying, you should use it, it's bloody brilliant, to sit there and say, I've got nothing to sell you. And I want to move away from kind of the skeptics, and I want to move more so into the success stories. And I know that this might kind of dance on the line of what is unselling and what isn't, but you must have many times where you've turned the impossible into possible using your theory and the way that you are. Do you have anything anecdotal, any experiences of that?
Yeah, I mean, listen, guys, think about you and insurance. This is global, okay? People do not like dealing with insurance. It's not a fun thing to deal with. It's kind of like your bank. Unless they really mess up, you don't want to leave. So I'm in an industry where inertia is massive. And trying to create pain around something that people hate doing is very tough. So one of the things I used to really try to do in my old days was I would talk about the product a lot. And I would talk about that, you know, we're local, you know, we have 85 people that are all trained in insurance. People just don't care. So I actually work with people. So when people say to me, oh, Kevin, like I left the ad agency business, went to insurance. So I'm going after the same prospects and clients now, moving them from ad agency to insurance. And by the way, I've never read an insurance policy in my life before I became an owner of it. And that is my greatest superpower, because I don't have the curse of knowledge when it comes to insurance. But I speak to entrepreneurs and I know the truth is this. When I ask them this question, and it was the hardest thing I had to figure out how to create this, and it goes against everything I was taught in sales. If I was trying to sell, I have a meeting, insurance right now, you guys would say, oh, Kevin, we've been with someone a long while. They're really good. They're good to deal with. I mean, they're okay. But like, I don't want to deal with insurance right now because myself and Jack are just too busy. We can't deal with the insurance. That's what you would do. It's a brush off. I would probably start by saying, like I do with all entrepreneurs, what do you think the number one reason why when bad shit happens to your business, insurance companies don't pay out? So it's a question, but it's an emotional question, because I got to get them from intellectual insurance to emotional. I got to get them from Spock to Kirk. And when I ask them that question, they usually say something like, because you're all a bunch of miserable pricks and you're greedy. Now, I don't fight that. I would say, you know what? I'm only in here 7 years. You're kind of right. And I got to hang around with them 10 hours a day. So there is some people like that, but that's not the number one reason why they don't pay out when bad shit happens to your business. What do you think it is? And then they grind a little bit and they'll say, well, it's because they say we're not covered. There's going to be some clause or some shitty wording in 2-point print that says we're not covered. Exactly. That's exactly right. So let me ask you this. As we're both sitting here, and I'm going to leave now in a second anyways, because how sure are you you're covered for what you should be covered for? Well, I've been with the guy 14 years. I hope I am. I said, I hope they pay out. So listen, do you want to roll the dice and hope they pay out, or you want me to take probably 15 minutes and I'll let you know if it's there or not. And you can, 70% of the time I can't do better, but I can give you two or three questions to go back and make his life miserable. What do you want to do? That is almost what I do every single time with a business owner, because they don't look at their insurance policy. Because when I owned the Idea Factory for 16 years, my accountant looked at the insurance policy. But I tell you now, if your business has a cyber breach, who do you think's going on the microphone with the BBC? Not the IT geek, not the accountant, the owner. I got to get insurance emotional. So if I don't get people emotional, I can't get them to move it, because the retention in the insurance business is 95% plus. I'm fighting inertia every single day. I'm not fighting another broker. I'm fighting inertia, and I got to get them emotional.
I love that, especially the question that you asked there. We've had therapists on, we've had hostage negotiators and different people, and we always like to get as many good questions as we can out of our guests. What are some of the other corker questions that you've got up your sleeve, Kevin?
Well, I mean, Costanza number one, which is very hard, is seeking the truth over seeking the sale, which is, sounds, everyone nods at it whenever I speak to a group. Everyone goes, oh yeah, no, I want to find the truth. But you really don't, because you're afraid to ask those questions. So I threw up in my mouth a number of times when I had to say this first. But these questions now literally come to me like Zach playing the guitar, and his fingers on his lullaby moving beautifully. It's like, God, like, it sounds like you're doing really well with your insurance guy you're with now. How long have you guys been together? I've been with my insurance broker for like 14 years. Wow, that's longer than most marriages last. Like, what? Like, what is the secret to your relationship? What do you mean, secret? Well, it sounds like you're almost like newlyweds. No. I said, okay, so you see him every year though, right? No, I haven't seen him in 4 years. I get that, like, because most people don't want to hang around with insurance brokers. So when's the last time you actually went through your policy with them? Well, he didn't call me for that. But you don't, you just admitted you don't like hanging out with insurance brokers. So you own a bit of this too. Like, why don't you just ask for a meeting? Well, I don't want to meet with him now because he's already irritated. So to me, asking why people really want to move insurance, moving insurance is a pain in the ass. And I got to remind them of that. And I got to challenge the truth, because as soon as they hang up from me, I know what's going to happen. They're going to go back to the incumbent and said, we're moving with Kevin Casey and his brokerage. And you know what the incumbent's going to do? I'll match their price. So I've got to deal with that up front. So I've got to say, Jack, can I tell you what's going to happen after I work for 30 hours and actually put you in a better position, give you more coverage, and get you a better price? Do you want me to tell you what's going to happen next? Okay. They're going to match it. And honestly, you can avoid seeing me all year. You're going to see me at a couple of summer events and maybe a concert if the Killers come here again. But you can avoid me. No, I'll give you the business. But you've been with them for 14 years. Like, why don't you just accept the matching of the price? I probably would. Because I wouldn't want someone to do that to me. Okay. So you're cool with breaking up after 14 years, because most people can't do that. That's what I mean by challenging. And seeking the truth is easy in concept. And you guys know this. It is friggin' hard to do. It is like, those things that I say now, I don't get nervous on. But man, there was like a bead of sweat coming down my forehead the first 20 times I did this, which is why reading books and watching endless hours of training isn't going to do it. You've got to get the reps in. And most of the Costanzas that I have are not going to feel very good. And they're going to feel very uncomfortable. But you just got to get the reps in. And I always believe that belief happens first. So I felt like if I listen to Tony Robbins enough and I heard him believe it, and I walked over hot coals, I would believe it and then I'd try it. It didn't work for me. I actually had to try the Costanzas first, fail miserably, like I did when I rode a bike the first time, and suddenly it worked. And suddenly the second time got a little bit better. And then 10 more times, it becomes part of your muscle memory. So going for no now for me, I'm 55, man. I don't got many years to go. Like, I can't be wasting time chasing people. And most of my life, I chased lies, not leads. And my whole thing that I celebrate in the office now, and we actually ring the bell for this, is someone gets a fast no, we talk about it. Beautiful. Because, man, I was all about the slow no. As long as I didn't hear no, I was okay with it. And now I encourage our team to ask those questions up front, because now you're going to have a skinny pipeline. It's not going to look as impressive, but it's going to be a true pipeline of leads, not lies.
Amazing. You know, jumping out, we in our business, we talk about four characters that you can be, and we work with different clients in different sectors. So one of them is the lawyer. So can you be a lawyer? Which is, you know, bring up evidence and challenge it and get to a conclusion where there's some doubt that's being built. And it sounds exactly like what you're doing in your business, which is, can I lead you to a scenario where the answer isn't, I definitely want to have a meeting. The answer is, I don't know. I don't really know if I'm covered. I don't know. There's some risk here. I don't know all the answers. And when I do, you're there as a, I can help you or I can't. It's up to you, which is beautiful.
Yeah. And I think we, you know, people take some of the stuff we share so literally, right? You've got to find your own words. So humor for me comes naturally. Humor for both you guys comes naturally. There's very elite salespeople that have no sense of humor, and they do very, very well because they find a style that works for them. So when someone says to me, I can't say to someone, so are you guys more like just married, or you're like more like roommates? I mean, they just can't say that, right? So I don't want them to be me. I want them to find a style that works, but the Costanza principles shouldn't change. And whatever style you do, do it your own way. Like, you know, I don't agree with everything Benjamin does. And I've told him this before. I love the guy. I mean, in 2019, I sat in the punch pit with him and he really helped me in a whole bunch of ways. But I'm not such a fanboy of Benjamin that I like the way he deals with gatekeepers, because that's not me. Because the gatekeepers in Canada, most of them are so tight with the CEO, they actually have a seat at the table. And you may mess around with them once and get away with it by being assertive and abrupt. It doesn't work for me. So what works for me on that is to be more like Columbo and just be real. So because I got to deal with that gatekeeper and that EA for life. And if I mess around with that CEO is going to go, you ever do that to my EA again, I'm going to punch in the throat. Like, that shit's not on. And she runs this office. And most of the EAs I know are actually smarter than the CEOs. Like, they know everything going on in the office. So why am I going to play a game? Now, it works beautifully for Benjamin. It doesn't work for me. So I just try to do the Columbo thing, which is, Zach, I don't even know how to get through to Mr. Big. And I know what your job is, and I appreciate it. Like, if you were me, what would you do? And the one thing I know is people love giving their opinions. And when I say that to an EA, and I look like, I know it's not your job to help lost salespeople from Canada like me. If you were in my shoes, like, how would you connect to Mark? And you know what they do? They give you advice. And all of a sudden that barrier's broke down. So I'm not saying it works every time, but I can't do the abrupt thing. It's like, is Mark in? Yeah, tell him it's Kevin. It's not my style. It's just not my style. But that's okay. And that doesn't mean Benjamin's right and Kevin's wrong. We had to find your own style. And part of the unselling is to take the principles seriously, but find a way to put your own individual flair in there so you don't become a carbon copy of Zach, Jack, or me. Like, you don't want to be that.
I was saying this to someone the other week that we do some training with. He was using this line that Benjamin uses, and he was like, it just doesn't work when I do it. Saying, what, why do you think? And he said, oh, I'm racking my brains. I don't know. And I said, well, Benjamin's a charismatic New Zealander. You're a middle-class British man. There's the cultural, the delivery is totally different. You sound like a head teacher. Benjamin sounds like naughty schoolboy. There's a total difference there in how that's going to hit. But yeah, it's really resonating. We're all singing off the same hymn sheet. I suppose if one thing that we found that's interesting when we're training people is when they're listening to a prospect, there's this panic that starts to set in of, I'm going to have to ask a question next. And it prevents them from being kind of present and in the moment and listening properly because they're thinking, what am I going to say next? And that seems to be almost like the hardest thing to crack. Were you listening there? And I can't know if you were listening or not. But what advice could you give people? Because it sounds like once upon a time you were doing things the total opposite way. What advice can you give someone around the psychology, around just being present, around listening? How can they make sure they're doing that?
Yeah, such a great point. Active listening and listening is totally different. And I think I spent most of my time in 2012 and before, when they were talking, I was actually preparing for what I was going to say next. That had nothing to do with what they were saying. So I really didn't hear anything for the first 15 years in sales. Like, I just didn't. I didn't listen. I actually believe this is where two things that Chris Voss teaches are really good for me and for my reps, which is if you can just mirror and label, if you only took that from Chris Voss's book, Mirroring and Labeling, and nothing else, because we're not saving lives. I mean, we're barely saving our own dignity. So like we can't compare ourselves to what he had to do for a living. No one died what we did except our souls. But mirroring, to me, when I get stuck not listening, I mirror as a way to get my head back on straight and figure out how to get back on track. And people, my team's always nervous of they're going to know what I'm doing. You just don't know what people are doing. Like you think people spot mirroring, they don't. If you do it right and you repeat those last words with a natural, not a Pinocchio uptone. I mean, if you, again, with practice, and if people aren't recording their calls, it's another ego thing, but I listen to my calls a lot. And if I get the tonality wrong, mirroring will be called out. And labeling can get you out of a lot of tense situations. So I irritate people now and then, and they say something like, you know, I hate insurance companies. Now, I could fight that, say, well, we're not like that. But I would say, label. It sounds like you've had a bad experience. And then I shut up, which silence is probably the third greatest thing that salespeople need to understand. It's there for a purpose. So to me, mirroring, labeling, and intentional silence, one of the hardest things I've had to learn. And I would still say, guys, I'm still learning because at 55, I still record every single call I make. I still work with our young sales team making cold calls still, because how can I write a book about any of this if I haven't done it for 15 years? I am not living in Cabo. I'm not writing a book from a beautiful deck overlooking Mexico Beach. I'm here in wintry Canada, and I still sell every day. I'm 55. And if I don't do it still, I got no right to talk about it. But I sell the way I talk about it in the book. The only thing I haven't talked about in the book are the 10 Costanzas that were shit. Because I want to put, people don't need to go through that 10 years of misery.
You spoke about some beautiful points there, Kevin. And I know that a lot of people that we've done training with, that they have that fear that I'm going to get the rug pulled from under me and people are going to spot I'm mirroring and labeling. Well, we had Sandy on from a Black Swan group, who obviously, and she said, we honestly, we will sit there and we'll see how long we can mirror and label Chris for. and he doesn't ever pick up on it. And it's like, if the guy that's driving this forward doesn't pick up on it, you making your cold calls is going to be all right. Kevin, I feel like we could speak to you all day. We're singing from the same hymn sheet. Before we let you go, I wanted to ask, obviously, we have our own approach and our own thoughts and feelings when it comes to mindset. You know, I like to talk about the remember you will die, and Zach's a big lover of the Stoics. What do you do for your mindset? Like what quotes or like what kind of go-to thought processes do you have to make sure that you've always got a winning mindset?
Two things on that, Jack. I love the fact that you end so many of your LinkedIn posts by reminding us on your Confucius saying of, you know, you're going to die someday anyway. So it's brilliant. I think if I was to give you my own spin on that, is you actually already died inside. You just haven't told anyone. And I think that's where I was in 2012 was, yeah, I might live to be 90, but man, I was like 41 then when that incident happened. I was already kind of dead inside. I just didn't tell anyone because we had an ad agency of 15 people and, you know, we were winning a few awards. And the biggest lie is when you go across that stage to get a trophy and you feel like, I don't even know who I am anymore because I'm doing things I'm not very proud of. So that mindset of never returning to Kevin Casey in 2012 is very important to me. I think Benjamin has a couple of tricks that he uses. I mean, for me, I think the one thing we don't control in life is time. And you guys are much younger than me, but I'm 55 and I have lots of sales reps my age. And I say to them, there's a lot better ways to spend time than chasing. And you can't lose what you never had. So why is going for no such a bad thing? I know you're struggling with it because you've been waterboarded like I was for 20 years. But can you do me a favor? Try it 5 times and let's go through it together. So my mindset is this: protect your time. And 70% of the time, Kevin Casey is not a fit for somebody. Let's get their call number one and let people know multiple times, not as a tactic, because it's the truth. Give them those off ramps to say it's okay if this doesn't fit. And I know there's an upfront contract, and the way they draw that out sounds very unnatural to me, honestly. If you said it like that, it's way too long. But I do let people know that, you know, sometimes people just don't like my accent. They don't like the way I wear my hair. They don't like the fact I got a tattoo. If this isn't feeling like your thing, I want you to be comfortable telling me no. And people go, oh, shit. Okay, that's great. But then you got to protect your status. And you actually got to go back the other way to say, and listen, I'm going to ask you a whole bunch of questions. Some of them are going to be uncomfortable. But if I feel like I'm not the best fit for you, I'm not going to be rude. I'll try to point you in a different direction. But are you going to be completely pissed off with me that if I say no to you? Do you know how hard it is to get people to accept that? They're like, you'd say no to me? Have you ever done that before? Yeah, 7 out of 10 times. Because it's not the right thing and I'm okay, but I'm going to point you in a different direction. And then when you try to point them in a different direction, they dig their heels in and say, I don't want to go there. I want to stay with you. I just told you we're not the best fit. Yeah, I don't care. You're the first person that's told me the truth in my life. But you know, I don't know if I would have been doing this if I was worried about payroll on Friday. It's much easier for me to do it now because things have worked out. But I started doing this in 2013 when some payrolls were hard to make. And you got to decide, do I want to be a professional or do I want to die inside? And if you can live the Cardone world, nothing against Grant Cardone. He's got the private jet. I don't. I get excited when I get an emergency room at row exit with leg room. He's way more successful, way more money. But I don't think that's a way to live. And it's just not my style. But if it works for you, go to Grantville. It's okay with me.
Beautiful. Kevin, what's the one sales book that isn't your own that you would recommend to everybody to read?
Wow. You know, there's so many sales books I've started and haven't finished, okay? Because if they come off like a textbook, I struggle. I also know some sales trainers that write 4 year. Now, guys, it took me 753 days to write mine. I don't know how people write 4 years. So you know who these people are. Every week they're out with a new book. I don't know how they do it. Honestly, I'm going to go old school here. Dan Kennedy from the 70s and 80s, even before my time. When I see Dan Kennedy's approach and what he calls takeaway selling, I think Dan Kennedy looks like a school teacher and he looks like a really someone from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, that principal. But man, that guy, to me, if I was going to say that would be the one sales book, I think he calls it No BS Selling. Dan Kennedy is a gem. And I still, if I turn around, it's still there. And that book is still the one I read the most. But it's not mainstream. And some of the others are just too heavy. I mean, I feel like it's people that are writing theory. My book is filled, and I'm shocked that you guys read it, but thank you. Or you paid someone to read it. It's filled with stories. And it's filled with examples and possible talk tracks. And I didn't say scripts. I said talk tracks. I wanted people to feel like I believe this guy because he's been through it. And I have been through the ringer. I've lived through heaven and hell, and I've had good days and bad days. And I get it when Tom Petty said, some days are diamonds, some days are rocks. They still are for me at times. And I still have bad sales calls. But I believe in the principles. And my dad, who did pass away, I know if he was a fly in the wall, he'd be very proud of the way I sell today. That's worth more than money to me.
Amazing, Kevin. Thank you so much. And if people want to check you out, they want to buy your book, where can they find you?
You know, I'm a first time and only time author. I'll never write another book again. It was just too painful. But I just put it on Amazon. It obviously did much better than I thought, but I don't even know what a scoreboard is in good sales, but Amazon has a weird algorithm. So I don't want to be a blowhard bestseller. That is horrible. But you know, I'm actually next week with I've got friends of mine who got kids with autism, and Amazon's really good. They charge, I think the book cost me printed $10, and it's a thick book, by the way. It's a grown-up book, guys. So if you're looking for a pamphlet, like, don't buy this thing. This is thick on purpose. I had publishers, I self-published by the publishers telling me you can't be longer than 215 pages. And I said, well, this is almost 400, and doctors don't get to decide. Well, I don't want to be a doctor because that textbook's too thick. My God, I'm going to save lives. Don't buy it. Like, if you want a 200 page book, don't buy mine. And Amazon, you'll find it. I'm actually in my own local town. I've given them 100 copies for free, and I'm putting all the money towards autism. This isn't really about money for me. I'm not selling coaching. I don't do one-on-one coaching. I'm the ultimate on-seller because I'm too dumb to know anything to sell except the book, and that's all I got. But I do have this, and I believe, Zach, you wouldn't qualify because your hair's too good and you got the square jaw. But when you get a bobblehead,
wow, you
know you've reached it. And Jack, you and I aren't the best looking guys. Like, Zach can turn off his camera now. You wouldn't qualify for a bobblehead, but Jack and I got a bit of a weird look. We don't have that Brad Pitt thing you got going on, but Jack, I believe for Christmas, someone needs to get you a bobblehead because you've got the perfect face for a bobblehead.
That is the nicest thing anyone has ever said.
Because what happens in our life, we know each other so well now, Kevin. I'm always looking for things that I can take and use against Jack that I haven't really used before. And that last 20 seconds there, I'm going to put it into songs. I'm going to send it him in the morning when he wakes up.
He knows
so
it.
You've really...
There's a reason you can't have a bobblehead, Zach. You know the reason, and I'll tell you off air, but we'll leave it at that.
Zach is going to have like a... When they do an NFL, our football over in North America, not your football... They create a bust of your face and, you know, it looks majestic and royalty. David Beckham would have one done. That's what Zach deserves because of his look and the hair and Conan.
We get the plasticine, some kid comes in and starts
twirling. We got to know our place. We are bobblehead guys. Like, we are just as effective as him, but like, no one's ever going to make a statue of us. They'll probably make a statue of Zach.
Oh, well, that was Kevin Casey. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kevin Casey. See you next time.
Bye,
Zach,
mate.
Wait. Now,